You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Phoebe Hoban. Phoebe, thanks so much for talking with me today.
It's great to talk to you. I hope it's cooler there than it is here.
Probably not, but it's quite hot. You're in New York, and I'm in New Haven. Yeah, it's in the 90s today. Phoebe, I want to talk to you about your books. You've written three books that are quite prominent, and perhaps we should talk about the first one, the book on Basquiat, because that's recently been reissued as an e-book, hasn't it?
In mid-May, Open Road did a really nice job issuing it as an e-book. It had been a hardcover and a paperback. It's been out for well over 16 years with a brief hiatus, and then it became an e-book, and I'm really, really happy with that because I think that the audience for this particular book, the people that are interested in this artist, are people that tend to use e-readers or their phones to read, and it makes it way more available. So I'm very happy with that.
So let's talk about that book a little bit because obviously that's an important book, and in the time since it's been written, his career has grown, and of course his status as a kind of mythic figure has also continued to grow. More exhibitions and more books have been written about him. Can you tell us a little bit about how you began writing that book and when that was and why you took an interest in him as a figure? Because at that point, he wasn't, he was one of the leading figures in graffiti, but certainly there were several others as well. Why did you choose Basquiat, and what year was that you began writing it?
I began the research for the book right after his death, and the backstory to how I came to write the book is that I was a regular contributing writer, so I wrote about 10 feature stories a year for New York Magazine. They were almost always about culture. I had just interviewed a woman who was then the curator at the Whitney, and she's now the director of the new museum, Lisa Phillips, a very prominent curator and museum director who was very, very much had her finger on the pulse of contemporary art. And I was doing a profile of her. And not that long before that, there had been a cover story, maybe half a year, a year before, on Basquiat for the New York Times, a very controversial story called The Marketing of an Artist, done by a journalist I knew from when I worked at Newsweek, Kathleen McGuigan, a very good story, by the way. And
the article you mentioned in the New York Times, was that the article where Basquiat was in a Armani suit
he was in a paint splattered Armani suit with bare feet, looking very defiant and at the same time regal, and obviously very proud of displaying the paint splattered Armani suit and the bare feet. I mean, he was very much an angry young man, and I hope that comes across in my book. He had more or less disappeared from the radar screen, and so towards the end of our interview, I just kind of said to her, whatever happened to Basquiat? Because she had selected him for one of the Whitney biennials, and he was the youngest artist in that particular biennial. And it was amazing because, you know, she said, well, he's just disappeared. What had happened to Basquiat was really sad, and that he was a heroin addict, and that he had become really somewhat of a recluse, that he didn't answer his phone, that you could only reach him by, like, telegram, that nobody had seen him in quite a while. And I thought, that would make an interesting story. So I started to look into it for New York Magazine, and indeed, everything she said was true, and then some. He was in really, really bad shape. Even his friends couldn't reach him. It was not a happy story, and I went back to my editor, to whom I'd already spoken about the story and who was very interested in it, and I said, I can't do this. It's too exploitative. I'm not going to do a story on the burnout of, you know, a great young black artist, you know, the sort of meteoric rise and sudden burnout. It's too cliche, but it also is unfair, and particularly because he's one of the only African-American artists to reach that level of celebrity, thanks to our society and the art world. I didn't feel comfortable at all with it. So we shelved it, but amazingly, about 3 weeks later, Basquiat died, which, of course, was tragic. He was only 27. He died on a day much like today when the temperature was soaring into the 90s. It was August 12th, 1988. He died in his loft on Great Jones Street, which is the scene I opened my Basquiat biography with. At the time, Great Jones Street was not the sort of deluxe restaurant street it is now. It was very much more seedy, and there were crack addicts, you know, lying on the sidewalk and that kind of thing. And he was found in his room, you know, face down in the heat. He was supposed to go to a concert that night with two friends. He wasn't answering his phone, and his girlfriend and the housekeeper found him, and they rushed him to Cabrini Medical Hospital, and it was too late. He had already died. The autopsy found that he did die of a combination of drugs, including cocaine. So, you know, it was just a really, really sad story. But his death made it a news story as opposed to what it would have been if I had written it just a month before. And so then I felt comfortable writing it, and I did write it. And it was a big story for New York Magazine. So then what happened was how it became a book. It was
just before the book. So then what you wrote for New York Magazine was in a sense the beginning of that book. It was a brief biography of his.
It was
rise.
Indeed. Yeah, more or less. I mean, it was a profile of the rise and fall of this artist and who he was and where he came from and why he was. Why people liked his work and, you know, who showed him. I thought that would be the end of it, but I was at a friend's book party not that long afterwards, and a very ambitious young editor approached me in the elevator, actually, and asked me if I wanted to do a book, and I said no, because in all honesty, it was not a happy story, and it wasn't I had never written a biography. Actually, I'd only written two children's books before. But I knew from working on articles that you really have to immerse yourself, and I tend to do that anyway, and I didn't want to immerse myself in something so sad and something so unpleasant in so many ways. But she was very persistent, and I like challenges, so I ultimately wrote a proposal, and they loved it, and I ended up spending almost 8 years working on the book, not because I'm slow, but because I continued to work pretty much full-time writing feature stories for New York Magazine, and then when I left there in 94, writing stories for the New York Observer and other places that I wrote freelance for at the time, like Vogue, and I wrote a lot of profiles at the time of a lot of different cultural figures. And the book finally came out in 1998. And, you know, it was very well reviewed in the New York Times. It was a New York Times Notable Book of the Year as well. And I think that people were fascinated by him. It remains the only definitive biography of Basquiat. There are a few other books out there, but it's the only full-scale biography for adults. There's one for younger readers. I'm not sure it's still in print. It might be.
And it continues to be read and drawn upon, I would imagine, for research because of its exhaustive nature. You got into more depth in that particular biography than anybody else did, I think, correct?
Well, I don't think, yes, it is a reference book, and it's actually required reading at some colleges in certain courses, but it's, as far as I know, because I've seen some stuff online that regards that, I think that it's as important as a document of the 80s and of the art market, but also the cultural scene in New York in the 80s as of the portrait of an artist as a young man. And that's because Basquiat died at age 27. And while he was enormously talented, he was only, you know, he was very young when he died. He'd barely skimmed the surface of his talent, but at the same time, his work had gotten weaker as he'd gotten more addicted and more cynical about the art world. But I think had he lived, he would have had a resurgence because his work has, you know, in Hollywood they say that an actor or film has legs. One of the reasons I agreed to do the book was that I thought that Basquiat's work has legs, and indeed it does. I mean, the most recent sale of his work at Christie's was a record-breaking sale. Well, not the most recent, but the most recent major sale at Christie's. Basquiat was a top lot. It sold for $57.3 million in May. That was a single canvas.
Oh, my God.
I think that, you know, the interest in him has only increased. I will say that part of the love affair with him, apart from the fact that he, you know, died young and left a beautiful corpse, as they say, including a beautiful body of work, is that there is a huge interest in New York at that time. New York at that time was a real mecca for up-and-coming young artists of all stripes, you know, musicians, fashion designers, filmmakers.
And we're talking about late 80s, early 90s.
We're really talking about late 70s, early 80s.
Okay.
And even by the mid-80s, this had started to be commercialized and to lose its, you know, its edge. But the early 80s was a primo time in New York. And, you know, I was here at that time. A lot of my friends were artists, so I knew the scene really, really well. And one of the things I hoped to do in the book was, I don't know if you remember this, but there were two major novels that had come out in the early 80s, Jay McInerney's Bright Lights, Big City, and Tama Janowitz, I think it was Slave of New York. The later one she wrote was called Cannibal of Manhattan, but I think her first one was Slave of New York, and please correct that if that's wrong. And both of them were sensations. And I remember thinking at the time, I was in those places. I know this scene. I should write a book like that. And so when I had the opportunity to write the Basquiat book, I brought a lot of my firsthand knowledge of the cultural scene in New York to bear. And it was an extraordinary scene. It kind of rivaled the 60s for being revolutionary and being innovative and being a cross-pollination of British pop culture and American pop culture, and there are all kinds of incredible mergings of fashion and music and art. For instance, the boutique Fiorucci that used to be down on Broadway just below St. Mark's Place, you know, it actually had artists doing their T-shirts, you know, and there, I mean, that was long before Uniqlo. I mean, it was just an incredible, incredible scene that included incredible clubs, and the clubs themselves featured a lot of cutting-edge artists and musicians and filmmakers. So it was a very exciting time to be a young person in New York. And I've had people come up to me at various Basquiat openings and tell me that they moved to New York because of my book. So there was a...
Well, I can tell you that Basquiat, for me at that time, I was in college. I was at SUNY Purchase, you know, graduating as an undergraduate art major, and was near my last year when I saw that article with him in that suit and in the making of an artist. And for me and for artists at that time, I think it was, in hindsight, it was a combination of things. I looked at that and I thought, I want that. I want to be him. And what I meant was I wanted to do whatever I wanted to do with art, and I wanted to make that much money. And it was a very strange kind of idea for me, for the other painters and artists that I was around, because I think for one of the first times in history, students were actually graduating, looking at figures like Basquiat. For me, it was particularly him thinking, it's possible to do that, which is a little bit perverse. But it was, you know, in hindsight, but it was part of the
ethic
of that time.
Yeah, I think you're right. He was inspirational. I mean, I do think a sad part of it is there was, as we all know during the 80s, a lot of greed and a lot of speed. And I think had Basquiat been allowed to mature at a slower rate, he, A, might not be dead, and he, B, his work would have continued to build, whereas it didn't. It kind of peaked very early on because he was being asked to overproduce because his work was selling like hotcakes. And it was a very star-making time for young artists. There were a lot of young Turks out there particularly during this period of neo-expressionism, you know, including Julian Schnabel, you know, Eric Fischel, you know, it just, the list goes on and on, David Sally. So there were a whole bunch of people that are still famous to this day. So, you know, it was kind of a sad example, but even in the films that were made based on Basquiat's life, Julian Schnabel's film and also the later one, The Radiant Child, I was present at the sort of Q&As for both of those premiere screenings, and people in the audience still wanted to know about New York at that time. That's what fascinated them. One of the things that you started to mention about it being ironic, that, you know, his story is inspirational, and that is ironic because he died tragically young of a drug overdose at 27, so he's not a typical role model in that way, and yet young people, young art students like yourself at that time, do find his story inspirational because his work did find an audience. His talent was recognized, and he did make a huge amount of money at a very young age.
Well, that's why I think it was also confusing to artists and as well as myself because, you know, in later years, because as much as it was inspirational, the idea of not only continuing a career as an artist, but wanting to make a lot of money as an artist is, of course, problematic for many, and I struggled with that of myself quite a bit. So it also created a standard that was almost impossible to reach for most artists, but something that they aspired to nevertheless.
Well, I wanted to just mention a few things. I wrote a new introduction to the ebook, and the introduction kind of brings the Basquiat saga up to date, and honestly, the decimal points moved again in his art, which instead of selling for, you know, well, for instance, okay, the $57.3 million painting that sold at Christie's in May, that painting had been bought for $4.5 million by the art collector and art dealer Adam Lindemann in 2004. So, you know, figure that one out. I mean, it had increased in value.
Jesus.
You know, from $4.5 million to $57.3 million is an enormous leap. You have to realize that places Basquiat in the same realm as some Picassos, some Rothkos, I mean, as true 20th century masters. But I wanted to mention some ways in which the Basquiat kind of, I mean, Basquiat's really become a brand, and as we all know, he's beloved of hip-hop artists like Jay-Z and Kanye West. They've all mentioned him in their rap songs. Jay-Z probably more than the others, who even did a sort of really interesting video called based on his 2013 Picasso Baby, in which he actually says, "I'm the new Jean-Michel." His work appears on products from sneakers to skateboards. There was a restaurant in the East Village that had a $64 Basquiat burger made of Kobe beef, although that that restaurant didn't last too long. In the Oscar-winning film The Big Short, there's a kind of montage towards the beginning of the movie, and if you blink, you'll miss it, but there is a picture of Basquiat's painting, Self-Portrait, as a heel. You know, so he's still very much alive and well in contemporary culture, and he has become a universal brand. And it's a brand that, you know, there's Uniqlo everything, dish towels, T-shirts, not just Uniqlo. I mean, if you Google Basquiat, you'll see mugs. I mean, he's on everything. He's a total cult figure. And when there are blockbuster shows, as there was at the Gagosian Gallery 3 or 4 years ago, there were lines around the block. You know, thousands and thousands of people went to see that show. So he's, if anything, more famous than he was during his lifetime and right after his death. But I wanted to segue for a minute, if that's okay. If you have more questions about Basquiat, I'm more than happy to answer them because, as I said, I'm thrilled that Open Road just published the ebook of Basquiat called Basquiat, A Quick Killing in Art, and available from Open Road online, and with a new introduction, as I mentioned, that does bring his story up to date, including, you know, one or two little lawsuits and the other movies that have come out and that kind of thing. But I wanted to segue because I'm always interested in artists that are a little bit maybe marginal. Now, Basquiat was certainly not marginal, but in American culture, very few African-American contemporary artists have reached his level of celebrity or fame. Even the really wonderful senior artists now, like Martin Puryear, their work does not sell for the amount that Basquiat's does. Again, I think that has to do with his being a cult figure and his having died so young and his having become really an icon of a certain kind of you know, young, brilliant artist who faces challenges of culture. But since we're probably running out of time, I did want to mention that I wrote a biography of Alice Neal. And Alice Neal was, unlike Basquiat, not celebrated very much during her youth. She had a brief moment as a social realist painter and had quite a few shows then during the Roosevelt era. She was, you know, she won prizes when she went to art school, but she didn't really become an art star, and she never became an art star that matched Basquiat's, you know, brilliance. She didn't become an art star until she was in her 80s, and that is partly because to this day there is a, you know, there remains a certain amount of sexism in the art world, and women artists are just not taken as seriously as male artists. And I think for anyone, male or female, who wants to think about a long-term career and the sorts of challenges that you might face if you really are addicted to your craft, addicted to your talent, if you have to create, as Alice Neal did, it's, you know, it's extraordinary that persistence and perseverance over time do triumph. And Alice Neal is now considered, you know, her work does sell for more than it ever did. She is represented by David Zwirner here in New York, who's done several wonderful shows of her work. She's a magnificent artist of the 20th century who's still not as well known as she should be, but her life also spanned from 1900 to 1984. So she lived through two world wars and all those different art movements and all those different revolutions. You know, she was of the age that she could vote when women got the vote in the 20s. She, you know, she was there when feminism first started and didn't exactly embrace it, but became a feminist icon, which only helped actually propel her career. And I think if anybody's interested in sort of what an artist was up against during the 20th century, including what happened to figurative artists when they were totally sidelined by abstract expressionism. I'm very proud of that book, which, unlike the Basquiat book, did not come about sort of by chance, but came about because I so admired her work, and her life was so amazing. She lived in Cuba in the mid-20s. She was part of the first modern art movement in Cuba. Her husband, her only husband, Carlos Enriquez, is still considered one of the major 20th century Cuban artists. She just had a fascinating, fascinating life. And I think that her example, in a way, is one that artists should maybe, you know, hope to... It's
yeah,
one that they should hope to emulate.
As opposed to...
Dying young.
Yeah.
I mean,
well,
she's
and
just hung in
for
there.
Fame and money, yeah.
Yeah, and then another artist who my most recent biography is that of Lucian Freud, who, although he did start to gain some real fame in his hometown of London in the mid-50s, it wasn't until the 80s here during the neo-expressionist movement that he got one of his first big shows. He was not a beloved artist because his work is really, really difficult and really, really, he really gets into the minutiae of human flesh. But he's still as Sigmund Freud's grandson and as an intellectual himself and as someone who was prodigiously talented, the sort of evolution of his work from these very flat but beautiful portraits and pictures of, you know, botanical pictures and pictures of birds and things like that, to, you know, his famous portraits of Sue Tilly, which also was a record-breaking sale at auction houses, as was Francis Bacon's triptych of Lucian Freud, which I think broke all records for all time a couple of years ago for a modern painting. So Lucian Freud is very much also part of the way the art world works now, and you know, he didn't always make a lot of money. He also, you know, he didn't make a lot of money until at least halfway, if not until later in his career, because he was a hard sell. But he's a fascinating painter with a fascinating life. And again, he died at, I think it was 87, I'd have to look it up, but Basquiat died at 27, Alice Neal died at 84, Lucian Freud died at 86, 87. I think it's well worth emulating an artist who has a long arc where an evolution of the work is readily visible, as opposed to Basquiat, who I don't want to say he was a flash in the pan, because I think if he had lived, his work would have, if he had survived his heroin addiction. If he had not died as, you know, unfortunately a junkie, he would, a word I hate to use, but he would, I think, have bounced back ultimately. He was on the verge of going for a cure in Africa. The timing was just off. I mean, he had been clean for a while, and that's one of the reasons when he slipped that he died, because the overdose was more than his body could take. So if he had only just made it through to that cure, I'm not saying he wouldn't have had a bumpy ride. He would have had a bumpy ride for numerous reasons: his own personality, his childhood, being a famous, you know, black or African American artist in what remains a still, you know, often racist society, as we've only too tragically seen by recent events. So, you know, he was up against all that, and he would still probably be up against some of that, but I think he had the talent to, had he lived, I think his talent would have developed. And that's what young artists should aim for, not achieving instant fame like a rock star and then dying like a rock star.
Yeah, I agree. And I'm glad you said that. You know, I think also the idea of also surviving heroin addiction is very difficult. I interviewed Andre Serrano not long ago, and he talked about being addicted to heroin, getting off it, and he said, but the most almost impossible thing in the world was getting off methadone. He said that was much harder than heroin, and the process, he felt, you know, nearly killed him. So I think it's also enormously difficult to do.
Of course it is, and addiction was understood less well then than it is now, and there were less good treatment programs. I mean, Basquiat was in rehab at least once. And, you know, there's no way of knowing if he would have lived. But, again, I find it ironic that people still look at him as inspiration. I understand that his art is inspirational, and that, therefore, people looking at his work, looking at the verve, the energy, the just sort of innate sense of composition and color, and also the political edginess, I think that that's always given kind of a second seat when people talk about Basquiat's work. He was really angry, and his work did speak to the times. I mean, all of, you know, his work was so word-based. He used so much verbiage, and so much of it were ironic comments on politics and on popular culture. And he was an omnivorous, you know, TV watcher and music listener and, you know, absorber of what was around him. And he had particularly like almost oversensitive antennae, you know, much like a Van Gogh. He just took in almost more than his system could bear. And a lot of that is right on the canvas. And that energy, I think, is what people relate to. I really hope they don't relate to the sort of chronology of his life, which ended so abruptly and so sadly.
I hope so, too. And Phoebe, I always ask people towards the end, what books are you reading now? Could be off the topic or not, or on the topic, but currently, what books are you reading?
Well, I do try to keep up with contemporary fiction, contemporary literature in particular. So I did read, when it first came out, Purity by Jonathan Franzen, for which I had mixed feelings. But I've also become kind of somebody who's really interested in particularly high-end mysteries, and I particularly like those which deal with art. And two I read lately that I really enjoyed and that I highly recommend are The Last Painting of Sarah DeVos. It was incredibly well done, and it was about sort of what happens when an art forgery comes back to haunt the forger, who's, in, you know, 20 or 30 years later become a famous curator, and who only did the forgery kind of by default. And the other one I read, which just came out in an American English translation, it's a Dutch author, was called The Last Weinfeld, and also involved a forgery. So that seems to be a popular theme in books about paintings, but I seek out books about paintings, and there's quite a large number of them going back, you know, decades. So those are the two I'm reading most, I read most recently. I mean, I also read Don DeLillo's book, K, which I thought was quite extraordinary. I'm a big Don DeLillo fan. I mean, I think I read 7 books in the last 3 weeks, so. But the art-related ones were the two I mentioned. So that's what I'm reading. And of course, I just read the Tony Schwartz mea culpa in the New Yorker about how, as he put it, he put lipstick on a pig when he wrote The Art of the Deal about Donald Trump. And that is a must-read for anybody. Jane Mayer, fabulous New Yorker writer, talking to Tony Schwartz, himself a wonderful journalist who ghostwrote The Art of the Deal for Donald Trump and has lived to regret it. So
I did not read
The Art of the Deal,
fantastic.
But I did read his
his articles,
his thoughts
kind of
now,
yeah.
And I think they are worth reading by anyone interested in the current electoral process. So I was just going to tell you the name of the author, though, because if anybody wants to look it up, it's a really, really well-done book. It is by, here we go, Dominic Smith, who's an Australian writer now living in America. And The Last Weinfeld is written by a Dutch writer who I think also writes movie scripts. Let me just see if I can find that one. And they were both really good reads and very well done. And his name is Martin Suter. So I think they're both good beach reads, thought-provoking and page-turning at the same time. And that's the best thing you can hope for in a mystery.
Absolutely. It's been great talking with you. But before we go, there'll be links to your books in this interview, so people can read them, buy them, and learn more about what you're doing. Is there anything else you want to leave us with that we haven't discussed?
I think that I've discussed everything I want to discuss at the moment. So I really appreciate your following up with the interview. I was impressed that it had to be scheduled. I looked it up in my journal. It was more than a year ago that we scheduled this. So I know you keep very busy interviewing people, many of whom are people I know or whom I'm interested in. So thank you for doing the show.
You're welcome. And Phoebe, I want to thank you so much for talking with me today. I really, really enjoyed this interview and also your books.
Well, thank you so much.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.